Hello and welcome to Pete's Percussion Podcast. I'm your host, Pete Zambito, here with you for episode 101 and my interview with University of Laverne percussion and music history professor Andres Espinosa. Let's get right to it. As is frequently the case, I'm meeting my guest for the first time during this interview. I became familiar with Andres when he appeared on the 2016 PASIC panel on race and identity that included previous Pete's Percussion Podcast guests, Matt Henry, Marvin Sparks Jr., and Neeraj Mehta, along with Michael Taylor. I enjoyed and appreciated his comments back then and looked forward to having him on my show, which he is now. Aside from his active percussion background, Andres Espinosa has made his mark in the worlds of performance, composition, history, and ethnomusicology. He's made a career touring and working throughout North America, South America, and Europe, and has had extensive college teaching experience in New England. You'll get to hear about all that and more immediately. We recorded this interview over Skype on July 19th, 2018, and it begins right now. So, Andres, just give me a summation of your percussion teaching and performing and writing responsibilities as they are.
Okay. First to start, my life doesn't only revolve around percussion. I know your podcast is about percussion.
Yeah.
My last degree is a PhD in ethnomusicology, which I got to that point through percussion. I started as a percussionist, mm-hmm. and I got to that point through percussion. And I am very much of the school of believing that the more complete a musician is in terms of knowledge, not only related to percussion, but relating to all aspects of music, the better musician, the better percussionist you would be. Mm-hmm. So being that, you know, I have a degree in percussion from Cuba. I have a degree in composition from Berklee College of Music in Boston. I have a degree in jazz studies from University of York in England. Okay. And I have my PhD in ethnomusicology. So, you know, I point in several directions.
Yeah.
So my percussion hat, and I realize your podcast is about percussion, my percussion hat comes on and off depending on the day. I do teach a lot of percussion. I have a few students at the university. I work at the University of Laverne currently in Southern California, in the outskirts of LA. I have a few percussion students. I direct the West African Drumming Ensemble, and I also created and direct and arrange and write all the music for the University Salsa and Latin Jazz Ensemble, where I also teach percussion, you know, to all the students as part of the curriculum. All the students learn to play what we like to call minor percussion, you know, how to play clave, how to play, you know, basic maracas and bells and stuff like that, so that they can, they know where the beats are when we're syncopating all over the place.
Gotcha. Tell me a little bit more about the school, because not a school I've heard of until I was looking up your information. So
the University of Laverne, it's a great place, man. I like it. It's a very small school, a liberal arts university, because I teach the granting institutions as a university, not a college. So it's a liberal arts university, 30 miles out of downtown LA. And they've been around for 126 years.
Okay. Is it public or private?
It's private.
Okay.
It's a private university. The university, the main campus, which is where I work, has a total of about short of 3,000 students, like 28, 29.
Okay.
Among those, we have the Department of Music, where we serve largely minors. So because the university largely believes in holistic ideals of education, so the combination of music and something else, or photography and something else, is most people in the university, I don't know if most, but a large amount of people in the university do double majors and or minors in an arts and then in something else, as and it's encouraged as part of your complete package of your education.
Okay.
So as that, we have the music department. We have a total of about 100 people combining minors and majors. Majority of them are singers, actually, because we have a very strong choral program.
Okay.
So majority of them are singers, and then we have a bunch of instrumentalists, a few drummers, you know, nobody who is officially a percussionist, but rather drums, a couple drum set players that take lessons with me as well, yeah, basically that. And also people take are able to take private lessons on instruments that are not their main instrument. For example, last year I had a trumpet player take percussion and rhythm lessons with me.
Okay.
And it's highly encouraged that people do that as to develop their musicianship further. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Great.
And my work officially, I am the music history professor.
Okay, that I was gonna get to that.
That's my official. That's what my contract says, that I am teach music history. There's only four tenure track faculty, mm-hmm. In the department, so it's a pretty small department. So whenever something is needed to be filled, you know, we fill it.
Right.
So I teach all the music histories, the traditional Western music history. I teach music of Latin America, Western music history, world musics rather. I also developed a Latino studies program and helped develop the classes for that program as well. I taught composition. I teach, like I said, I teach the salsa ensemble, the West African drumming, etc. Yeah. So,
when you were brought in, did you? I'm understanding fully that you're being brought in primarily to do the music history part, but. Mm-hmm. Did you say, hey, I can do this, this, and this, and this too? And they're like, cool. Or did you get in and you're like, you know, this place could use this, this, and this?
Both.
Okay.
When they brought me into the university, the person who taught music history had retired.
Okay.
And the choral director had left. So they hired two of us at the same time. They hired the choral director. She is awesome. And super, super energetic and has great moves and ideas for the program. And they brought me as well, wanting to bring something, rather somebody who was new and different and thought openly about how we music. The person who taught it before taught it in a very traditional manner. And I was taught with, I was brought into the university with the idea of saying, you know, we know that you can do this, but what else can you do? What else can you contribute? Because, you know, the department is small, but because it's small, we have all these avenues open to us in terms of how we can do this. And you know, your input will be not only greatly appreciated, but very likely put in practice very quickly, which is mm-hmm. what has happened.
Right.
You know, we've renewed the music history sequence, for example. It was based out of basically teaching everybody Western music history from the Middle Ages to the 21st century.
Right.
From a Western music perspective, and now it includes music of the United States, Western music history, and world music as part of the curriculum.
Okay.
Myself being a drummer, of course, when we talk about music of the U.S., we talk a lot about rhythm and groove mm-hmm. and stuff like that. We also talk about the connections of New Orleans with the Caribbean, talk about the connections of African music in the United States and, you know, the connections of Latin American music into the United States. And all of those, as you know, they have strong rhythmic components.
Mm-hmm.
So we delve a lot into that idea.
And and that's in the, like, every major takes that music history course. Is that what you're saying?
Every major and every minor. Every major has to take all four. So there's four of them. Every major has to take two Western music histories, one music of the U.S. and one world music.
Okay.
And every minor has to pick two of those.
Okay. So how often, what's the, your sequence of teaching all of these classes? Do you teach them all every semester, or is it like, I teach this every spring, and what's the kind of the way that works?
I teach one Western music history every semester.
Okay.
One or two, we have Western music history one, Western music history two, and whichever one of the other ones I want to teach. Generally, I go one world music, one U.S., fall, spring, in that order.
Okay. Who's the general student that comes to that school? I mean, is this a lot of out-of-state? Is this a lot of in-state? What's the, where do the students come from typically?
About 30 miles around the university.
Okay.
It's a very local university.
Okay.
You know, the university is a Hispanic serving institution. Southern California, of course, I call Southern California Northern Mexico, to be honest with you. and actually, a lot of my Mexican students agree with me. I feel fairly at home when I can walk into any store and just start speaking Spanish, and I know that it will be fine. Nobody has a problem with that, and I will be talked to in Spanish as well.
Right. Where did you grow up?
I grew up around several places. I was born in Chile, and I lived all over. And in my early 20s, even though I had lived for extended period of time out of Chile, but in my early 20s, I completely moved out of Chile.
Okay.
And I've been living in the U.S. since 2001.
Okay. You speak Spanish, and that works out for, you know, these places where you're going, but they're not, it's not Chilean, or right? I mean, it's the culture is different.
The culture is different, and that's a loaded question.
Sure, I know.
Because my field officially since my PhD. Mm-hmm. Is in ethnomusicology, but my field crosses, you know, music with sociology, with anthropology, and right. More specifically with Latino studies, mm-hmm. or Latinx studies, as we say currently. You know, and I feel very comfortable with the Latinx studies. I feel very much at home with it. Mm-hmm. Because part of moving to the U.S. meant that I became a Latino. You know, right. before I moved to the U.S., I had no idea that I was a Latino.
I know what you mean.
I made this clear to a lot of people, you know, because people don't get this if they were brought here very young or immigrated here very young or never questioned this or were born here or et cetera. Mm-hmm. You know, I was Chilean, you know, and that worked out very well. You know, and I was fine. And eventually when I moved to the U.S., and I was like, oh, you're Latino, so you like this and that. And I'm like, I do? Okay, sure. I've never tried chimichangas, but I feel they're delicious. You know? So it was that kind of a thing. So that process was a very introspective, and a lot of thought went into it, and a lot of it came out in my work when I was doing my doctorate. Mm-hmm. Because I discovered that I was a Latino and that I shared much culture with people that had come to the U.S. Who were thrown into this mix. And that mix, that sort of hybrid mix.
Yeah.
You know, I like to play to my favor as a hybrid rather than separating myself and say, oh, I'm Chilean, this is what I like, and you're Colombian, that's what you like. Mm-hmm. Saying, well, there's a lot of commonality here. Let's take advantage of that.
Yeah.
And that's that to me. So I have fully embraced the Latino moniker, and I like to play with it. Mm-hmm. You know, oftentimes people ask me, you know, where I'm from, and I say I'm Latino. And they say, where are you from? Well, I'm Latino. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm from Southern California currently.
Yeah. All right. Is that your way of gauging how much they actually want to know where you're from?
Yeah, it's sort of tongue-in-cheek, you know. You know, I'm a little a bit of a sarcastic myself, you know,
yeah,
so I enjoy playing with those things. But and I like to push them because it gets people to think, you know. Mm-hmm. and I pushed him, and I know that oftentimes I'm perceived a bit of like, who is this guy? What does he think he is? And I was like, I'm pushing it, and I realize that it's part, it's part of how I do things.
Well, how long did it take you to? Would you say it took for you to like you said, you now push back at it, but how long did it take you to get to that point?
Oh, a very long time. Like I mentioned a little bit before, it was a matter of self-discovery. Mm-hmm. Because I didn't realize what it actually meant to be Latino. All of a sudden, I was Latino. I was like, oh, okay, cool. You know, and all of a sudden, I had to start thinking and discovering that I had all these commonalities that I wasn't sure that I knew that I had, and I had to think about it. But once I went with it, I was like, oh, okay, this makes sense. I don't know, about maybe 6 years ago or so, I fully embraced it.
Okay.
You know, because it requires you assuming a new identity.
Right.
You know, which is a very complicated thing to do.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden I was like, well, if I say I'm this thing, then that closes a lot of doors. You know, especially within the Latino community here in the U.S. And it's like, oh, so you are from Chile, so you like this, and that's how you get categorized.
Right.
You know, if you say I'm Latino, people get like, oh, okay. So then they have to start thinking. That's exactly what I wanted to do.
Okay.
Okay. So what do you mean? So oftentimes my comeback is like, you need to ask where I was born, right?
Uh huh.
Right. Yeah, I was born in Chile. That's a no-brainer. That doesn't mean I identify myself. I live in the U.S. For 17 years.
Right.
You know, I identify myself largely as being from the U.S. at this point. You know, because I go back to Chile and I get I feel disoriented for a couple of weeks.
Mm.
You know, because I haven't been there in such a long time. I don't go there that often. Mm-hmm. You know, and I go there and I'm like, oh wow, the codes and you know what street crosses with each other's street. My friends call me and say, oh, just come over. I'm on this street and this street, and I'm like, where is that? Come on, man. You grew up in this city. You know the city. He's like, yeah, I know where the general area of that thing is.
Right.
But I'm gonna have to walk 10 blocks in each direction to find the intersection that you're talking about.
Right.
So, and that comes with living here, you know, and it's not doesn't have anything to do with being, you know, snob or trying to deny that identity. It's just life has changed significantly, and you know, and that new identity doesn't erase the other one. But it's the current one. Identities are changeable at times. You know, it depends where you are, what's the situation, who you are, and how you are, etc. And understanding. And I haven't closed myself to the possibilities.
At what point, when you're studying and you're doing it, and I don't know if this is during a doctorate or just in graduate study itself, but at what point did you start to really place all these things in your head? Because you said you're doing this a lot of times when you're studying, I guess Latin American experience. Mm-hmm. When did you start figuring this stuff out in your studies?
Well, I started thinking about it probably in when I was in undergrad at Berklee College of Music.
Mm-hmm.
I already had a degree in performance in percussion from I had studied in Cuba for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I had gotten a degree from there, and then I moved to the U.S. And in the U.S., I started thinking about it, because when I was playing music with people expected me to play certain things, you know, that were, and this is the term that actually got me thinking about it, when I got a piece of sheet music, and the piece of sheet music on the top left corner said Latin.
Right.
And I'm like, I'm not sure what that means. I know what that means.
Right.
But I'm not sure what that means.
Yes. Uh-huh.
You know, I know what you want me to play.
Yeah.
Okay, cool, got it. I can do that. That's not called Latin, bro.
Right.
You know?
That has a name. It has a specific name.
That got me thinking from the point of view of performance practice, you know, that's really what sparked the whole thing. You know, and so all of a sudden we had the Latin jazz ensemble, and we are playing 95% Cuban music.
Mm-hmm.
So is this the Cuban jazz ensemble? Is that what we're doing?
Right, yeah.
No, so, or are we going to do some South American music? Because I know all these other pile of grooves that are from there that are also Latin, but, you know, so what does it really mean? So I wasn't really talking that much with people about it, you know, but I was it sort of sparked the thought.
Mm-hmm.
And then the more I started studying, I continued studying and kept going in my development, the more that the idea became prevalent, you know, that there was this thing called Latin music. The bunch of people that were called Latinos and or Latinx.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a whole field of studies that was Latinx studies. I'm sorry about that ding.
That's okay.
there was this whole field called Latinx studies that, you know, did something that I sort of belonged to, but I wasn't really sure how.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to find, since I was in this new reality of living in the U.S. and doing all the things that I was doing, I had to find out a way of figuring out how I belonged there.
Right.
As I started embracing the moniker, I discovered that with that pile of grooves that were also Latin, I could just start using them.
Yeah.
You know, and this, of course, coming primarily from musical performance. I hadn't really gotten into ethnomusicology deeply yet.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, I went to England, and there it became more prevalent even. When I did my master's, I did it in England, and I kept thinking about it, and I kept writing. I had my degree from Berkeley. It was in composition. Mm-hmm. So I started writing music in that idiom, and, you know, I started figuring out ways to combine for it to be Latin, you know, that weren't necessarily the standard way of doing it, which is mainly Cuban music, and figuring out ways of changing the grooves and changing the lines and you know, let's do this thing in seven and then and it still sound the same kind of way.
Right.
So figuring out what made up the idiom. And as I did my master's, it became more clear because at that point, I really started doing research into traditional music of Latin America and how to apply it to jazz position. That's what I did my master's on.
Okay.
So I wrote my final project, the product of the master's, was a big paper studying the music of the cajon, mm-hmm. the Peruvian cajon, with detailed transcriptions and solos and ideas, and then a whole bunch of compositions using that music as a basis to form new jazz compositions. God. So at that point, it's all started combining, you know, this whole new idiom, and that basically kept going, and I kept writing music, and eventually went fully into the ethnomusicology route, because I wanted to delve more into the meaning of what it was, this thing, this traditional Latin, and all these terms that just kept being thrown around.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of traditions and Latin and, you know, and et cetera. And that meant something, but it wasn't fully clear to really anybody, or very few people were really clear to what it actually was.
What?
So I just continued to develop that idea.
What's the title and the thesis of your dissertation?
My dissertation is called Una Sola Casa, the Poetics of the Metabarrio, Salsa Consciente and the Poetics of the Metabarrio. But I found out, and sort of took a bit of a left turn at one point, I've always liked salsa, which is another one of those terms that is vague and nobody knows what it means.
Yeah.
And it's claimed, this ownership of the claim of the term from various sides.
Mm-hmm.
And I discovered that a lot of the expectations of being Latin were tied to playing salsa. You know, and salsa was this sort of Caribbean hybrid that I really like. I really enjoy. I grew up listening to salsa, so it was really familiar to me. And what I discovered the more that I listened to it is that there was a lot of commonalities between various people of different countries that were all found in salsa music, you know. So, and I decided to look why, What were those commonalities? Because, okay, salsa is majority or largely Cuban music with a bit of Puerto Rican music and maybe some Colombian groups in there, largely and very generally speaking. You know, so what made the recognition of people of Colombians, Venezuelans, Cubans, Puerto Ricans, you know, New Yorkans, New York Latinos, etc., mm-hmm. what made the recognition with that music?
Right.
So I started to think about it, and what I came up with was the thought that that largely the lyrics and to a lesser degree the music made markings of place that were familiar, and this is what I came to call the meta barrio. My theory is that the Latino doesn't socialize in the house, but rather socializes in the neighborhood,
okay.
in the barrio. Okay. So the in salsa, there are many descriptions of the barrio, of the neighborhood. You know, the neighborhood smells like this, feels like this. Somebody is yelling behind, yo, come over here, lunch is ready. Mm-hmm. You know, the smell of beans being cooked. Mm-hmm. You know, all of that were familiar, you know, and those descriptions were familiar to a lot of people that weren't necessarily from that barrio. So what I came up with, the idea that I came up with, I did take it quickly from Chris, the ethnomusicologist, I think he's at NYU now, from Chris Washburn, that he mentions in his book, the idea of that salsa has created a meta barrio. That's all he mentions in his book. And I was like, huh, that's interesting. And I ran wild with the idea of the meta barrio. Mm-hmm. The meta barrio, and so what I came up with was basically a map of common reference points of the meta barrio through the lyrics, you know. So say, and this is what the person says. This is what it means. And so, long story short, and of course, 400 pages worth of it.
Right.
long story short is basically what I did was create an analysis of salsa lyrics from the salsa quote unquote from the 40s up to the 90s. Of about 130 songs or so,
yeah,
that mention different ways that Latinos would identify themselves. Mm. You know, and I created several layers. One layer was the first layer of being Latino was racial or ethnic. You know, so people who identify themselves with the mixture with being of African descent, of indigenous descent, and of Spanish descent. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't get into Brazil. That's a whole different story. But, you know, those three, and, you know, so I started looking for early lyrics that mentioned these topics, mm-hmm. Largely. And then I got to the set, what I consider the development of this stage is the idea of social class, of mm-hmm. class, you know. And Latinos are also identify, aside from being Black, Indigenous, and Spanish, they identify often with being poor, you know. Mm-hmm. So there is a social displacement. And with that idea of the social displacement, I started looking for all kinds of lyrics that mention social displacement. Mm-hmm. And then the third elevation of this system was the idea of recognizing oneself as united Latinos. You know, and the how the music traveled from the United States, because salsa is, after all, created in the United States, created in New York, from the United States towards Latin America. You know, salsa has had a huge influence in Colombia and Venezuela from the United States. You know, Cuba, Puerto Rico travels to the United States, and then it gets exported
right.
back to Latin America. And in that export, there's a change of language,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's really the time that we start to see the idea of Latinos. We are one. We share all these things. We have all these things in common. So rather than separate ourselves because you are Colombian and Mexican and you are we have all these things. So let's unite and work together.
Well, that sounds like what you experienced then.
That's it. I told you at the beginning of this, it was a very self-discovery thing.
Yeah.
You know, and I came to it and I tried to figure out how did it justify itself.
Yeah, okay.
You know, because was it just my crazy theory or could I prove this thing?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it happened to a lot of people. Because I talked informally with a lot of people. Does this happen to you? I said, yeah, it does. Mm-hmm. You know, at a place like Berklee College of Music, where you have students from all over the world, and you're playing with people of Puerto Rico, people of Puerto Rico, people of Cuba, people of Colombia, and we have so many similar codes. Mm-hmm. You know, that I'm like, huh. Okay, so there's got to be something to it.
I was going to move to something else, but actually, as I wrote in the email, you know, the first place I encountered you, and it wasn't because you and I necessarily met each other, but it was from the couple of years ago at PASIC, the panel on race that you were on with Matt Henry and Neeraj and Marvin Sparks.
Marvin Sparks, yes. Yeah.
And so I want, if you could just talk a little bit about how you came to be on that panel and your experiences. I thought it was one of the best things I saw at PASIC in like 5 years. That hour.
I'm happy that to hear that report. That was my first year at PASIC.
Okay.
I've never been to PASIC. I remember as a teenager reading Modern Drummer, mm-hmm. and back in Chile, which was very hard to get. You know, you would get a Modern Drummer, you know, once every 6 months, one would show up. A friend had an uncle that went to the U.S. and they bought a Modern Drummer and they brought it as a present for them, and we would all read Modern Drummer. Mm-hmm. And I remember seeing the ads for PASIC and dreaming of going to PASIC one day. Mm-hmm. Oh, it was so cool to go to PASIC. So eventually that was 2 years ago?
Yeah, 2016.
2016.
It was
November 2016.
So I had a... and I'll tell you, I just interviewed Neeraj yesterday, and he reminded me that thing happened 2 or 3 days after the election, so everyone was.
You're totally correct.
And it was like, oh yeah, that was a part of that whole thing too.
You are totally correct. I had forgotten about the election. It was charged.
Yes, it was charged. That's a good way to say it.
You're totally correct.
Yeah.
How did it happen? Okay, so I was trying to, on my side, you can ask Matt Henry more details about how it happened on his side, because he was the lead organizer for the panel.
Yeah.
On my side, I was trying to figure out ways to fund my way to PASIC.
Okay.
You know, so just very practical. Mm-hmm. And of course, the easiest way to fund your way to PASIC through university system is to present.
Yeah.
So I was trying to figure out, and I poked Matt Henry, I don't know, about a month before PASIC, and saying, I see you're organizing this panel, you know, I do a lot of these. Say, oh, no, we're complete, you know, we have somebody. And somebody actually canceled last minute. I don't remember who it was. So when I saw that somebody had canceled, I reached out to Matt Henry again. I said, hey, you know, you have somebody canceled. I'm going to PASIC anyway, mm-hmm. funding, no funding.
Right.
So let's do it. Let's make it happen. And he was like, all right, let's do it. Give our own perspectives on how we had worked within the confines and getting in and out of the confines of doing percussion from the different parts of the world in the Western world.
Yeah.
You know, what have we done, and what was our responsibility, you know, what was ethical from us, not ethical, were we appropriating, you know, are other people appropriating cultures, you know,
yeah.
That kind of deal. That was the basic gist. I mean, all of the people in the panel have different experiences. So we all brought something interesting. For example, Michael Taylor, he's biracial, you know, mm-hmm. you would look at him, you would think he's a white guy with dreads, but he's actually biracial.
Yeah.
So what he projects to the average person that doesn't know who he is a very different story than what he actually is. I mean, he's a phenomenal djembe player and has studied under Mamadi Keita for, I don't know, 20 years at this point.
Yeah.
He's one of his biggest pupils. So he's the real deal.
Yeah.
You know, you wouldn't... Most people wouldn't expect from how he looks and how he conducts himself that would be the case. However, he can prove you wrong. So it puts people off the place where they are, mm-hmm. and that's part of what happens, because you know people have certain expectations and we tend to shape them, you know, especially when it comes to teaching word percussion, because percussion as a corpus of knowledge in the Western world, we only tend to associate it with music. In many, many parts of the rest of the world, if not the majority of the world, it is incredibly tied to everyday life and culture of people. And it's not separated as music, but rather it's part of life. So it's in that, with that being said, we need to consider how we approach this thing and acknowledge the people that are making this their culture, their lives, the way that they do things, etc. And that was basically the spark for the panel. It was called a panel on race, and race, of course, is a very controversial term because it's really a term that does not exist, you know, biologically. Socially, it's a creative term, it's a social construction.
Right.
So that social construction, we played from there, you know, and what actually race meant and what actually, you know, is it actually, do we actually mean ethnicity? Do we even play with the term race? Do we use it? Do we not use it? Etc. So from there, the conversation went on, and basically each one relayed our strategies to work around, not around, but work within and within and without the terms, you know, and how to best and more appropriately develop these ideas. You know, I mean, my wife and I are writing a paper currently that's going to be presented at the African Music Symposium in Ghana in August. It's exactly about this. It's about teaching West African drumming in institutions of higher education in the U.S. Neither my wife nor I are African. So, you know, but we both have been teaching West African-based percussion, Afrocentric percussion for the last, I don't know, 20 plus years.
Mm-hmm.
So what do we have to say about it and how do we do it? And so basically it's putting a lot of those thoughts on paper.
You've taught at 3 or 4 other institutions before Laverne?
Yes.
So what were the ways that you were working at these schools?
As adjunct.
Okay.
I did the adjunct gig for 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad I got out.
Yeah.
It's tough, man. The adjunct is tough. I don't wish it upon anybody.
Yeah.
It's a very hard gig. Unfortunately, the education system these days is run more business than education.
Right.
So there's a lot of these very low wage hire of to be honest with you, highly qualified people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Majority of the adjuncts have masters, and if not, they have PhDs.
Right.
So you know, to have a PhD, to be working for pennies on the dollar, right, is tough.
Yeah.
It's tough, and you know, and then likely after grad school and everything, you have a bunch of debt, etc.
Yeah.
So I work as an adjunct at a whole bunch of places, mainly in the Northeast, which is where we were living at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I did it through my PhD, and I did it a couple of years after my PhD, which is when I got the position here at University of Laverne.
Okay. Were they music history gigs, or were they percussion, or what was the?
I did music history gigs. Of course, as an ethnomusicologist, it is expected that you would be teaching world music.
Right, sure.
So I did teach a whole bunch of world music. I did a African drumming ensemble, and I developed and directed the BU, Boston University, Salsa and Latin Jazz Ensemble.
Okay.
Which was a huge hit. Nobody expected that.
Mm.
You know, right after I finished the PhD, the person that was running the ethno ensemble, the other ensemble, wasn't there that semester, and the director of the department asked me, can you run a salsa ensemble for one semester? And it's sort of like, yeah, why don't you try it and see what happens?
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, sure. You know, it's like, you think it's going to go well? I'll give you all I got.
Mm-hmm.
First semester, we had 22 people registered for the ensemble. So I had, I think, 9 horns and 4 percussionists, 4 singers, and full rhythm section. Everybody was really into it.
Yeah.
So it created a beast. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, it was needed. BU, Boston University, is a great institution that is still very rooted in traditional ways of making music. So it has a very much a conservatory model.
Yeah.
But students are not necessarily that much into the conservatory model. They want other things as well.
Yeah.
And this was a welcome relief to a lot of people.
Yeah.
And plus, the music is a lot of fun.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so people were having a blast, and we gave a whole bunch of concerts, and people were dancing. Of course, BU has a salsa dance team, you know, and they're great. And of course, and all of a sudden, we have this live music salsa that is available. So every time we play a concert, the whole salsa dance team, that there were like, I don't know, 40 or 50 people in that team. They would come to our concert, so we would have the audience, and then 40 or 50 people dancing in front of us. So it was just fantastic.
Yeah, that's great. When you're at these various institutions, was there ever any possibility, did you seek, I would imagine you sought it out, but was there any possibility that any of these positions would turn into anything more than just the adjunct?
Well, that's always the hope.
Right, sure.
That's
was it ever possibly real or no?
Tenure track positions these days are hard to come by.
Sure, yeah.
You know, even full-time non-tenure are hard to come by.
Right.
I applied to BU, actually, because BU had an opening at that time that I applied to. I didn't even get past the first round. Of course, the first year out of PhD, you know, and fresh out of PhD, I didn't know. But also in terms of ethnomusicology, there are few positions and there are a lot of ethnomusicologists.
Yeah.
The position that I got here at University of Laverne, and I have talked to the chair of the department, there were about 150 applicants.
Yeah.
All of them with PhDs, all of them with, you know, in related fields, all of them good candidates.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really a matter, more than anything, it's really a matter of fit.
Sure.
Rather than your qualifications.
Right.
Are you really what we're actually looking for?
Mm-hmm.
So that's really how what it comes to. Would any of these institutions have hired me for a full time? Possibly. You know, it could have worked, but you know. There was no promise, and you know, and if the position would open, I applied, which it actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get it.
Gotcha.
You know.
Okay. When you're in the Northeast, are you able to find a way to piece a living together? It's not cheap over there. I know that. That's first off.
It's not cheap over there. California is not cheap either.
Sure. Yeah.
The adjuncts here at the University of California system pays better than it does there. I was working at 4 different universities at the same time.
Oh my god!
And commuting about 700 miles a week.
Oh so, my gosh!
So it was a tough gig, man.
Yeah,
it was a tough gig, and you know, likely what I was making wouldn't have been able to live on. The way that I was living, of course, we're married, so you know, between my wife and I, we could make it work.
Mm-hmm.
But with what I was making in the Northeast and working that hard, I don't know, probably afford a, you know, 1-bedroom somewhere.
Yeah.
No, which as you know, drummers, we need more space.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Of course. Yeah.
I come with a collection of drums.
Yes. Okay, the bedroom is for the drums. Now, where am I going to be?
Exactly. So this is the drum studio.
Right.
Let me see where I can put a bed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Can we fold it up? Can it fit in the pantry?
Exactly.
I gotcha. I gotcha. So when you were working all those gigs, were you living in Boston or were you living somewhere else?
I was living an hour away from Boston in Maine.
Okay.
Maine is gorgeous. Mm-hmm. I still love Maine dearly. We still have our house there.
Okay.
I love Maine dearly, and I was there. My wife lived at the point that we met. She lived in the next town over, which is actually New Hampshire.
Okay.
So we moved one town because it was a lot cheaper, but it was in a different state.
Yeah, yeah.
It was crazy. The properties in New Hampshire were like at least a third more mm-hmm. than they were in Maine.
For the same size or something.
Right? How about we move 2 miles that way uh-huh. and pay a third less?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I was like, yeah, that sounds reasonable.
Yeah.
So I was living in Maine, an hour away from Boston. It's near a town called Portsmouth. That's the town in New Hampshire called Portsmouth. And it's an hour from Boston and an hour from Portland, Maine, which are the two large cities that are close by.
Yeah.
So it allowed me to go play gigs in either one.
Okay.
And work in and work universities, mainly in Boston. I also worked in University of Maine system for a while. They were very good to me, and I talked to them about giving me a full-time gig. They couldn't swing it. Mm-hmm. University of Maine system doesn't have any money, so
yeah,
that's the basic gist of it. But yeah, I was living in what's the term that they use? The greater Boston area.
Which apparently is Maine and New Hampshire and probably Vermont too, if they wanted.
No, not Vermont, but Maine and New Hampshire for sure. The states in the Northeast are a lot smaller than the rest of the country, so
right.
You know, from where I was in 15 minutes, or about 15, 20 minutes, I would have crossed into three states. I would go Maine, New Hampshire, Massachusetts in 20 minutes.
Well, and the other thing, the other part that you hadn't mentioned, but it's also true with the adjunct part, is that you can also just get pegged as the adjunct if you do it for too long.
Yes. Yes. I honestly had a couple years left out of that gig. I had said to myself, you know, I cannot do this for that long. This is way too much.
Yeah.
So I'm going to, if I get, I'm going to do a couple years. If I don't get a full position of some sort, I'm just going to do something else.
Yeah.
Because it just wasn't sustainable.
Crazy. Okay. So let's back up. So was there anyone else in your family that was in the arts?
Yes. All of them, not professionally, none of them professionally.
Okay.
I don't have any professional, but you know, my dad plays guitar, plays percussion, plays saxophone, sings. Mm-hmm. He's a professor of sociology though.
Okay.
That's his gig, you know, but he's a very good singer, you know, hacks at the sax.
Uh-huh.
You know, plays guitar, you know, that kind of a thing. My mom is a fantastic painter.
Is that some of her stuff? I'm sorry, but what's behind you? Because I see some beautiful paintings right behind you.
That's African art. Okay. That's from Ghana. My wife has a strong connection with Ghana. She lived in Ghana for a while.
Okay.
So we have a lot of African art around the house.
Awesome.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Okay. I just had to. I had to ask because I'm enjoying looking at it.
It's all good.
Yeah.
My grandfather was a fantastic photographer. You know, with experimental photography and super super modern photography. To be honest with you, and he in the 60s and 70s he was doing what is now considered rave music.
Okay.
he would take electroacoustic music like Stockhausen and Varese and stuff like that, mm-hmm. and would do his experimental photography, dark room and slide projections, you know, of super trippy photographies, uh-huh. all analog. This is 1967. It's all analog, yeah. with electronic music behind it.
Wow.
So super, super modern.
That's practically a filmmaker. You call
it. Yes, it was like a 45-minute slideshow.
Yeah.
I saw it a couple times in the 90s. He was older. He wasn't as edgy. Mm-hmm. But saw it a couple times. One of the things that one of my pending projects that I have to apply for a grant from somebody at some point, because he showed his stuff around the world, a bunch of embassies in Eastern Europe and the Corcoran Gallery in D.C., so all over the place. And one of the pending projects that I have is to actually write music, original music to those slides. Mm. My music inclinations, I blame them on my dad. my dad, every time he went somewhere, you know, for a conference or something, he would bring me an instrument from wherever he went. I was into it, you know, he would play music, I was into it, and he would go to Brazil, so he would bring me a berimbau, he would go to Peru, so he would bring me a cajon, and, you know. I wasn't encouraged to go into the arts, though. I was strictly forbidden of becoming a musician.
Wow.
Yeah, my mother wouldn't have any part of it, especially because I in school I used to do well in math and chemistry and all sciences.
Yeah.
So my mother was like, no, you're not going to do music. You're going to do something science-based.
Right.
And I'm like, I don't want to do anything science-based.
Yeah. I like doing music.
They want to play drums. I was doing gigs when I was like 14 years old. I was playing professionally, getting paid doing gigs, and it was a heck of a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Why on earth would I want to go to do science?
Yeah, yeah. I'm with you on this. I don't, yeah. Tell me a little bit about Chile's music, the music program, the school, music in schools, however that works out.
That's a complicated one. Well, I grew up in Chile during the time of dictatorship, in the 80s. Mm-hmm. The dictatorship ended officially in 1990. You know, of course, the ramifications are still felt today.
Sure.
And
what was that? Remind me of the dictator's name. I know.
Pinochet.
Pinochet. Okay. Good. Yeah.
73 to 1990.
Yep.
And anything to do with the arts was seen as dissident. Mm. So the arts scene between early 70s through the 1990s, the art scene in Chile is marginal. You know, it's complicated, it's marginal. You know, of course, there was music, was art, but it was complicated to become anything because, you know, there was no scene or just about no scene. You know, and you were seen as a dissident, which at that time was extremely dangerous.
Yeah.
You know, so if you wanted to become a musician or an artist and you wanted to say something, you know, you could get killed or disappeared.
Yeah.
It was literally like that. So there was a prevailing feeling of not becoming a musician, which is part of why my mother didn't want me to become a musician. She had that lingering feeling, even though the dictatorship was over by the time I was going to start going to college and such.
Yep.
But the music scene in Chile, the modern music scene in Chile, really starts appearing in the 90s, which is when I started participating in it. In the 90s, I was playing with a bunch of bands and playing funk, and the whole thing became more open, clubs began to open. And in terms of education, the music education in Chile until about 20 years ago, if you wanted to study music, you went to conservatory.
Okay.
Conservatory in Chile, the education requires you to do a total of 8 years worth of conservatory training. So it's quite complicated to spend 8 years to become a percussionist at a college level of 8 years. And then when you come out of college, there are no positions open because you've only been prepared to play a Beethoven and Wagner and Mahler, and that's what you've been prepared for.
Yeah.
And and basically there's one symphony orchestra, and you just have to wait till one percussionist retires.
Right.
So you can apply for the gig.
Yeah.
But that might take 20 years.
Right. You might not get it at that point. So
I might not get it.
Yeah.
So there was a from the conservatory in Chile, which I attended for a couple of years until somebody told me that music died after Bach. There was no music after Bach.
Right, of course.
Which I was like, really?
Yeah, yeah.
At that point, I left the conservatory.
Yeah, that's when you say, you know what? I think we're done. I mean, I don't think I need to hear any more from you.
The popular music scene in Chile became much more interesting. Mm-hmm. So, for until about 20 years ago, if you wanted to play popular music, there was no institution to really study popular music.
Okay.
You found private teachers.
Okay.
Which is largely what I did. Mm-hmm. We would get a video from the Drummers Collective every once in a while, that pirated 20 times over video of the Drummers Club, Dave Weckl playing, with Chick Corea in '86 or something, and we get 20 pirated over,
uh-huh.
And you would spend hours rewinding trying to figure out that lick.
Yeah. So hold on one sec, because if you're saying that there's no, that Chile has essentially no scene, right? Is that like there's no music, there's very little music, or at least public music scene, right?
Well, currently there is.
Right, but when you're growing up, there isn't.
In the 80s, growing up, yes, there's very little.
So what ends up being, are they pulling from, are the musicians pulling from just other countries and styles, or is there something actually, was there internal things for Chilean musicians?
The large majority of the music, of popular music in the 80s into the 90s was rock.
Okay.
Argentina had a... had a strong rock scene,
okay,
and that influenced largely the rock scene in Chile.
Okay,
so you had that '80s sort of experimental rock scene going on. On the other hand, you also had a lot of Andean music,
okay,
with the pan flutes and what you see today, that kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Very well done, with a lot of vocal harmonies and beautifully done, and that was sort of it.
Okay.
Chile is a small country,
yeah.
So there isn't a large selection of things. Mm-hmm. So musicians would pull from all kinds of sources. I mean, musicians are resourceful,
yeah.
So they would try and find ways to make things happen.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what people did. In the 90s, when Chile really opened in 1990, things started coming in. Information started coming in.
Yeah.
I remember to me the 90s was a discovery of the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Mm, yeah, awesome.
and that was all of a sudden, I was like, whoa.
Uh-huh.
And in the 90s, also what happened is that a lot of people were exiled. So a lot of people in the 90s started returning to Chile. Mm-hmm. And with that return, they were bringing tapes and vinyls and of all kinds of music.
Yeah.
There was this guy, Jimmy something, I don't remember his last name, Jimmy something. He's a rapper. Mm-hmm. And he came from Italy, if I remember correctly. He arrived from Italy and he brought this whole bunch of videos and recordings of rappers and, Run DMC and Sweet. Public Enemy and what have you. And graffiti videos and stuff like that. So that sort of produced in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, a huge hip hop scene in Chile. Mm. To this day, we have a fantastic hip hop scene in Chile.
Awesome.
And I played a lot with that scene in the early 90s. I did a lot of gigs with them, and hip hop bands at that time would have a live band with them, So there were four rappers, guitar, bass, drums, percussion, the whole thing. Yeah. And that that sort of was the boom of my generation in terms of music, when really we started getting the music scene happen. It wasn't an underground phenomenon anymore.
Okay.
At that point. Probably the best way to describe the 80s and 90s more than anything underground.
Yeah.
There are several groups there, in a lot of rock, experimental rock, and, you know, a lot of like the Police style trio, like power trio kind of a thing.
Yeah.
A lot of that, but that was, they were all fairly underground. You really had to seek them. Because once again, it was seen as dissident and it was dangerous. You know, and there was curfew, and, you know, you couldn't, if it was past 11 o'clock, you couldn't be on the street, etc. So it was very complicated.
How would you describe Chile's relation with the rest of the continent?
Chile is a weird place because it's completely isolated. Mm-hmm. On one side, you have the Andes, and on the other side, you have the ocean.
Yeah.
So okay. It's separated from everybody else.
Okay.
And
it's a very long, from like, isn't it? It's on the west coast, and it's just like
it goes, I don't know, about half of the length of South America.
Yeah.
So in terms of climate, it's got everything. It's got from the tropics to Antarctica.
Yeah.
The northern part is completely tropical. The southern part is perpetual ice.
Yeah. So when you're growing up, how much of the rest of the country do you actually see?
Oh, I actually got to see a lot. It's very common, like you would do here in the U.S., you would go camping.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you go camping somewhere else in the summer.
Yeah.
You know, so you go, and my dad loves hiking and camping, so we would go to all kinds of places, you know.
Okay.
I did get to see a lot. There's a whole bunch of folk music in Chile as well.
Okay.
That was not seen as dissident or anything like that, just seen as cultural expression.
Mm-hmm.
People didn't make a living out of it. These were, I don't know, fish, you know, people who did all kinds of other work that also played music.
Yeah.
Which, to some degree, I suppose I can credit that for my interest in ethnomusicology. Because I saw all these things all the time. My father being a sociologist.
Yeah.
We would go to these places, and at the end of the day, they would play music. They would all sing and play guitar and, you know, bring out a couple of drums and sing, etc. So there is that. And that was not necessarily underground, but, you know, it wasn't mainstream either.
Does Chile have a kind of a version of the Pacific Coast Highway or something like that?
Route 5.
Okay.
Route 5. We call it the North-South.
Okay.
The North-South, and it goes all over. You know, it goes through the mountains, then into the coast. I mean, the distance between the mountains and the coast is mm-hmm. an hour.
Yes.
You drive right, you go to the mountains, you drive left, you get to the coast. That's pretty much it. So you get in and out of Highway 5. You get in and out all the time,
mm-hmm.
whether you're going to the coast or the mountains.
Yeah. Red Craig, so you go? Do you go from there to Cuba?
Yes.
Okay. So how does that end up happening? That you go there?
For? Well, like for the U.S., Cuba is a forbidden place. For the rest of the world, it's another country.
Right. Yeah.
You know, at some point when I had already convinced everybody that there was no choice but for me to study music,
mm-hmm.
my father said, all right, well, why don't you go somewhere where they actually play all these things that you want to learn? Chile, we have very little of these things. And my dad being the open person in terms of this sort of idealistic in these ways, it's like, okay, I see you have a few choices. You can go to Brazil, you can go to Cuba, you can go to Africa, you can go to India.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so where do you want to go? Like, I want to go to Cuba. I'm like, all right, there you go. Here's a couple $100, figure it out. You know, get some gigs, then I'll get you started. You know, here's a couple $100, mm-hmm. get some more money, save for the ticket, you know. Well, so it's sort of like what most people here in the U.S. would do as a study abroad. Mm-hmm. First, I wasn't going to, I was going to college for engineering at this point, but I really wanted to study music. So it wasn't really a study abroad, but rather a move abroad.
Okay.
you know, college in Cuba is extremely cheap. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't a major expense. It was actually kind of great because I didn't really have to spend much money for college.
Mm-hmm. Did you seek out the scenes, the music scenes there, I would assume?
Oh,
man, or did it seek? Did you even have to? Did that? Was that not even that hard? You're just like, I just.
I got there and my mind was blown. How is this even possible? And the more I got into it, and to this day, the more I get into it, the more mind blown that I am. I mean, I was 19 when I arrived there.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm a 19-year-old on my own in Cuba. So it was like,
yeah.
You know, oh my gosh. and the music scene in Cuba is phenomenal. I got there. I went initially I was gonna go for 2 weeks to check it out and figure out where I was gonna live and make a plan. I ended up staying for 3 months.
Mm.
You know, just I was there. I was gonna go and I was like, well, I'm gonna go check it out, see how it is. And then I was like, I'm gonna change my ticket. I can't do it now. This is amazing.
Yeah.
I got there and of course I had a foreign currency, so I could actually afford to do something, and people wanted that foreign currency, so I figured out that there were plenty of teachers for what I wanted, and I went to check out the university. I enrolled in university and they transferred a lot of what I had done back in Chile in terms of previous studies, but then that wasn't the real interesting part. The real interesting part was what was happening outside of the university. The jazz scene in Cuba is outstanding. Mm. The musicianship, it's mind-blowing.
Yeah.
Because of the system they have set up, they have a feeding system that you go to specialized schools depending on. From elementary school, you go to schools that feed whatever it is that you're going to be doing. So if you're a musician, and of course this is changing nowadays, but if you're a musician, you're going to get a music education from very young. You know, so that's fed, and then once you get to conservatory, you can already play a lot. You know, and once you leave the conservatory, you can play the heck out of your instrument. So that's what I encountered, and I had no idea. You know, I had a basic idea, but I didn't know to what extent. And you know, I was really into Cuban jazz at that point. And I got there, and, you know, a jazz festival is happening. I go there in December, jazz festival is happening. And one of the first bands I see is Iraquere. I don't know if you ever heard Iraquere.
Who? I'm sorry?
Iraquere. I-R-A-K-E-R-E.
No, can't tell you. Sorry.
Okay, do yourself a favor. I went to Iraquere. It's an institution in Cuba of how jazz should sound and what jazz can do.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw them live and I was like, what? How can they play like that? So so from then I kept coming back and I lived there for a little over a couple of years. Finished the degree, and like I said, most of the stuff was happening outside of the university. I got in touch, connected quickly with drummers, very traditional, very folk bass drummers that and to this day I am still connected with them, you know, very, very closely. They're family basically at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And these people can play, man. These people, they stuff they do is incredible.
Yeah.
And you know, and I just kept learning from them more and more and more and more and more.
From there, do you just end up going to Berkeley?
My mom had moved to Washington D.C. at this point for work.
Okay.
And was insisting that I move to the U.S.
Okay.
Not insisting. That's not the right word. Highly encouraging.
Yes.
That I moved to the U.S., you know, that it would be, you know, safer, easier, you know, I could figure out ways to make my thing happen, etc. So I was like, all right, fine, I'll move to the U.S.
And just out of curiosity, how is your English at this point?
Oh, very good. I had studied English since I was little.
Okay.
That's one of the most useful things I've done in my life. I after school program, some people went to play soccer. I went to English school. You know, I also lived in, for a while in Canada. My dad was doing his PhD in Canada, so I lived with him for a while, and I got to actually put it into practice.
Yeah.
So I my English was fairly good at that point. Although, as my wife likes to point out, I didn't know the difference between fun and funny.
Okay.
So, you know, oh, that was funny. And people would look at me like, what do you mean? I meant to say that was fun. Okay. Anyway, so I moved here, and Washington, D.C., I didn't really care or like the city at all. So I went back to Cuba.
Okay.
So I was like, forget it, I don't like this. Let me but my upon insistence of my mother that I applied for university in the U.S. to continue my studies. So I applied to a bunch of universities, and Berkeley gave me a fantastic scholarship, and said, come on over. And I'm like, all right, cool.
Your degree, what is your degree in from Cuba?
Performance in percussion.
Okay. Was there a final recital? What was the capstone for that?
Yeah, I'm sure.
Okay. What'd you play on it? Do you remember?
All kinds of orchestral excerpts.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, no, it's a classical percussion, you know, and I play a piece on bata drums as well. Was one piece of your choice, all these orchestral excerpts, you know, they're the typical, you know, the typical excerpts, you know, all the Ravels and a lot of the timpanis of Wagner and the such, that kind of a thing. One keyboard piece that I completely butchered. Keyboard is not my thing.
Okay.
And then one piece that you wanted, so I played. I did a bata piece with my teacher, because at this point, you know, basically a couple months in, the university was something that I did, but the real learning was with the folk drummers, because it was drumming. Folk drumming in Cuba is a spiritual uplifting connection with the natural phenomenon on the earth, and the rhythm of the earth flows through the drums, and once you experience it, it's just it and touches you. It's a thing of beauty, and you know, it has meant the world to me to this day, it was a life changing, profound experience to see all of these connections that I had been reading about and you know, thinking about and all of that. All of those connections happening strongly, and I'm like, wow, they're in the center of all of this, there's drums.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm like, this is incredible. So that's really where my real learning out of Cuba happens. You know, the university is fine, I get a degree and everything, but you know, I'm thankful for it. You know, my reading chops improved significantly, and you know, I learned a lot of things that I didn't know, but you know, to me, the real life-changing part was not the university itself.
So when you go to Berkeley, you have an undergrad degree already, right? I mean, from
yes.
So what? So is it still? Are you still there 4 years, or is it a shorter program?
Well, I discovered quickly once I got accepted into university that my undergrad degree from a country that did not exist didn't really serve anything.
I see.
So when I moved here, I tried to do an equivalency, you know, that my degree would count for anything. I didn't absolutely count for anything. So,
oh, wow.
So I went to Berkeley, and I went to, and they gave me a scholarship, and I said, of course I have to go.
Right.
Berkeley, has only recently begun to offer graduate degrees. They wouldn't have taken me for a graduate degree anyway, because I didn't have an undergrad officially. even though I did, but anyway.
I'm not bitter. No, I can. I mean, that I'm sure you're downplaying how pissed off you might have. You probably were about all that.
Yeah. you know. So I went, and then I said, okay, well, I'll go and declare major. You know, and I did credit by exam and a whole bunch of things, and I got I got passed all the basic stuff, you know, all the basic theories, not all, but a whole bunch of the basic theories, etc. I did my audition in percussion, and my the guy who took my audition, his name is Eddie Castrillo. You might have heard of him, Eddie Castrillo. He's a fantastic drummer and percussionist. He used to play with Arturo Sandoval. And he goes and looks at me and he's like, "So why on earth are you here?" And I was like, "Because they gave me a good scholarship and I want to keep advancing and I want to get better at playing drums." Like, "But you know how to play drums. You know, why do you want, you know what you have to do? You know how to do it. You have all the tools to your disposal. Why do you want to come here to play more drums? Do something else." And I'm like, okay, let me see what I can do. At this point, I had also suffered an injury, some tendonitis on my hand. Mm-hmm. So my playing was a little shaky at that point because I didn't have strength in my left hand.
Oh, wow.
I don't know if you suffer tendonitis, but it sucks. To this day, I suffer tendonitis, so it's tough. You know, your hands don't respond the way that you want them to.
Right.
They are slightly late, and you know, like, I want that hit right there in that moment, and it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
So it's tough sometimes. So I started figuring out what else could I do, and I decided to really focus on writing music, which was, and I discovered that I could write music because I had studied harmony, I studied theory, and you know, why don't you try your hand at writing music? And so I thought to myself, and I started. And I discovered that there was a lot of ways of expressing myself through music that wasn't necessarily playing music, but rather writing music. So my degree from Berkeley was in composition, jazz composition.
Got it. So do you still, how much are you, I mean, it's in composition, but how much are you still playing? Just as much as you can handle physically?
Yeah, pretty much. I'm still playing, I'm still gigging. To this day, I mean, I'm not playing as much as I used to, but also I'm focusing on school at this point because I'm venturing into a path that I had no idea what I was doing at the beginning. You know, I was trying to figure out how to write music, and I never really written music.
Yeah,
I've done you know, feeling the Bach cantata kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm really writing music, and the music, and Berkeley is a fantastic place, and it has the amazing players, and all of a sudden you get your music played because of the nature of the university.
Yeah.
So you get your things played and they're sounding, and I'm like, wow, this is interesting, they're sounding. So I start really going into that, and I keep playing. I play with a whole bunch of things. Of course, coming from Cuba and having these life-changing experiences, to playing, you know, music that I didn't really care for. You know, I was playing a Jimmy Buffett cover band.
Okay, you know, awesome.
I wasn't really happy about it.
Right.
You know, it paid.
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
It paid.
Yeah.
And like, so, you know, and all at the same time, I'm writing all this badass music, you know, playing 1716 and all kinds of crazy stuff.
Yeah.
Then down in Margarita.
Right.
So you know, so it was a life changing time.
What about being in the Northeast and the climate change?
Can I curse?
Please.
Fuck. I hate snow. The cold.
Yeah.
I would live in the Caribbean any day.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the bottom line. I had no clue. And my wife is from Boston, and to this day I'm astonished that I actually live there. We were there last Christmas with the whole family.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like 3 degrees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what my wife was insistent, go take your son to play out in the snow. Why?
You go play with him.
We eventually went to play out in the snow. We had a blast, don't get me wrong.
Sure, yeah.
But you know, but it was like, ugh.
Yeah. because you were driving 700 miles a week, and I'm sure in some ridiculous conditions.
Yes.
So your winter driving skills are probably really good then. Well, really good.
Better than any Californian. But...
Oh, I bet, yeah.
both people in LA drive terribly. I remember several times canceling class because of snow. Mm-hmm. And just being safe and saying, you know what, I'm not going to drive 100 miles on a snowstorm to teach a class. You guys can live without me for 2 or 3 hours today.
Yeah.
So it's part of the deal of living in the Northeast.
Yeah.
You know, that it's part of the deal. Climate is difficult, and it's from November to late November to March,
right?
At least it's complicated.
Yeah, I grew up on Long Island, so I know it's not, and it's definitely worse where you were, but I do know that.
Okay, you do know the drill.
I know the drill. I do think it's like that's a great time to look at you were getting any gruff from these schools, you'd be like, you know, what would make me consider this is if this job was full time. I'm just saying.
That would have been a good thing.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I wasn't getting any gruff from the school. I would just simply tell them, you know, I need to be safe. I'm not going to be risking my life to come and teach one class to which only a quarter of the students are going to show up anyway.
Right. Of course.
You know, I'm not gonna be driving on this crazy blizzard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is the next thing that you go, is that when you go to the UK?
Yes.
So full how
scholarship
does,
is the answer to your question.
Yeah, so how did that come about?
I applied, there was a little at Berkeley, I was about to graduate. There was a little pamphlet outside the scholarship office that say, apply to our program in the UK, full scholarships available. Sure, I'll apply.
Uh-huh.
Boom. You didn't get in. It's like, oh, well, I tried.
Yeah, yeah.
2 weeks later, you know what? The guy who actually got the scholarship didn't take it. You're the runner-up. And you want it? Yeah. Okay, you have to come here in 2 weeks. Okay. So, yeah, that's how I ended up in the UK.
And what was the program?
A University of York Masters in Music, MA in Music.
In performance, or what was the...
No, officially in jazz studies. The way that they do university work in England is slightly different than in the US. Or at least University of York. I don't know, to be honest, I don't know the other universities. But University of York, what they had was a MA in Music with a pathway in X, Y, or Z.
Okay.
So we had all the masters in music students. We all had a bunch of core common classes, and then you had classes in whatever it is that you wanted. But they were, in my case, because I was the only one interested in jazz studies at that university. I had one-on-ones with my teacher, so it was more of a doctoral kind of a deal.
Okay.
After a while of classes, about 6 months worth of classes, they just basically let you on the loose.
Okay.
You finish your project. You're about 6 months in, fine, when the classes end, you write a proposal for your project, present it to your main teachers, they approve it or deny it or ask you to edit, whatever, and then go on. You know, do it, and then come check in every few weeks.
So how long did it take to do to do that degree?
Well, I did a bit of a tricky thing. My wife now, then girlfriend, was living in the U.S.
Okay.
And I was living in the U.K. So what I did is I did my proposal was about the shift of Latin jazz, the Latin jazz scene in New York.
Okay.
What I had seen, and of course, this is where this you can tie it to what I was doing before. To what I was talking about before, I saw that there was a shift in the Latin jazz scene, that there were a lot more South American-based jazz in New York.
Okay.
You know, there's a guy named Edmar Castañeda, for example, who plays harp. And he's Colombian and plays harp and plays jazz with harp, traditional Colombian harp.
Okay.
He is phenomenal. You know, there's another guy named Papo Vasquez who does Puerto Rican style jazz, etc. So I noticed that there was a shift on the definition of Latin jazz from strictly Cuban to all these other things, mm-hmm. and there was a scene for these. So what I did, it was a jazz studies-based ethnomusicological project. So I went and I interviewed all the musicians, a whole bunch of musicians, and from that whole bunch of musicians, I transcribed all their interviews, and I asked the questions, you know, so why are you changing it? What does it mean to be changing it? What does it mean, you know, for Papo Vasquez? Papo Vasquez, he is a fantastic trombone player. I asked him, you know, what does it mean? You're Puerto Rican, you know, and you're bringing this. And he's like, oh, we're Puerto Rican. We've been here way longer than the Cubans. We never got an our due. Mm. Colombians were saying, you know, we have all of this incredible music that nobody knows about. So we want to present it, and we have et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there was this whole movement of things that I thought was very important. So I produced a big paper on the change of music from Europe. So that required, this is why I wrote the proposal, mm-hmm. that requires me to go to New York, to move out of the UK. And to be honest with you, the UK was difficult. I was flat broke. Mm. You know, the visa that I had was student visa, so it didn't really allow me to work. Mm. So I did gigs on the sly. You know, so I couldn't really do much. So it was kind of difficult. The University of York is in the northern part of England, which is, how do I put it mildly, the lack of diversity is challenging.
I bet.
You know, so it wasn't an easy living, and it's very expensive too.
Mm.
You know, I wasn't in a city like London or something like that where it would be a strong scene and a lot of diversity and I could do a lot more things. Was, York, it's a medieval city.
Yeah.
You know, that is known for its medieval city and the University of York.
Right. And that's it, right?
So, yeah. So there wasn't much to do once you walked around the city, you know, for the first 3 months I walked around the city and I got to know the city very well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's gorgeous, fantastic, the walls and the Roman pillars and what have you.
Right.
And then I go to the university.
Right.
And that was about it. I did get to do a bunch of gigs in Europe itself, in mainland. I did a bunch of gigs in Italy with a good friend, a good Italian friend who was doing his PhD at this point.
Yep.
Marco Visconti Prasca. Okay. Phenomenal composer and saxophone player, plays exclusively baritone sax.
Wow!
So you know, he's phenomenal. So that kind of a thing, and then I came back into New York and I did my whole project from New York, and I submitted my project, and that was the end of that. But they did give me a full ride, so I can't complain.
Yeah.
And that was really when I started getting into ethnomusicology itself, because my advisor. For in the UK was an ethnomusicologist, Neil Sorrell, and he's also a jazz musician, but he really saw that the ethnomusicology part was very well a part of what I was doing anyway. So he really encouraged that.
Yeah.
He gave me a bunch of stuff to read, and you know, I was like, oh, check this out, and read this, and so on.
All right, I finish up with random ask questions. You ready?
Go for it.
All right. What's this one's not totally random, but what's because you still do a lot of percussion stuff, obviously amid the music history. But what's an issue in? We'll stick to percussion. What's an issue in percussion education that most gets under your skin and bothers you the most?
The way that we keep thinking that hand percussion is minor percussion. And it's not taught the same at the same level and with the same seriousness and study and dedication that we offer to orchestral percussion, for example.
Gotcha.
My instrument is hand percussion. That's my instrument. I if you ask me to play a gig on marimba, I could probably wing it if it's a simple gig, but that is not my instrument.
Yeah.
My instrument is hand percussion. I play conga, bataca, horn, djembe, etc. and the technique and dedication to it takes the same amount of effort that it would take to master any other instrument, and it should be taken just as seriously. So this the study of what we call hand percussion or wall percussion, however you want to call it, I don't like either of the terms, to be honest with you, is huge. And in terms of percussion education, we still fail to understand that it's an instrument that requires just as much dedication.
I was thinking of this. I wonder if this is still the case. But what's the most impractical item of clothing you own?
Impractical?
Yeah. Like, is any of the winter stuff that you had in the Northeast still in your collection? I'll put it that way.
I've gotten rid of the majority of it. My big pocket coat lives at my in-laws' house. Most impractical for my current situation, the most impractical I own are probably my winter snow boots.
You still have those?
Yes.
Okay. When you go back.
I'm probably going to start living at my in-laws house pretty soon.
Okay. Gotcha. What is a great movie and what is a terrible movie?
Fitzcarraldo.
Oh, yeah.
Werner Herzog is one of my favorite movies.
Yeah.
Do the Right Thing by Spike Lee, also one of my favorite movies.
Great.
Do the Right Thing was actually my introduction to hip hop.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Flipped out on this Public Enemy, Fight the Power. That thing was on my Walkman with a cassette.
Yeah.
For the longest time.
Yeah.
And was a bad movie. Romantic comedies I don't care for.
Just generally.
Yeah, I don't really care for romantic comedy. I can't think of one. I don't really see many bad movies, to be honest with you.
Okay. Is your wife a fan of romantic comedies?
Nah.
Okay, that's good.
She's really into British Victorian dramas these days.
Oh, okay. She hasn't gotten you in that, I guess.
We've watched the odd one, but not really.
Let's see, what is your biggest kitchen mess up?
The lid of the salt shaker came off over the soup.
But
I'm a fairly decent cook.
Okay. Good.
You know, so those things don't happen very often.
Yeah.
Another mess up would be the time that I sliced my finger open. You know, so. As a drummer, it's kind of hard to do that one.
Yeah. Okay, what is your favorite Michael Jackson song?
Don't Stop Till You Get Enough.
Yes.
Yeah.
Probably. Yeah. That's good. I'm always a fan of anyone pulls from either Off the Wall or the Jacksons. I'm like, all right, good.
Quincy Jones, man.
I know.
Those arrangements are killer.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's when pop music was it, man. Yeah. Those arrangements are killer.
Yeah.
Killer.
What is one either piece of culture of some form that if you meet somebody for the first time and they say, I like blank, and you're like, we're cool, like right off the bat, what would that be for you?
Espresso.
Okay. That's what, yes, yes, you meant.
I am a huge, huge coffee fan, not in terms of quantity, but in terms of quality.
Gotcha.
And I'm always seeking out espresso. My father-in-law is very good at this, so we're always seeking it out.
Yeah.
And so when somebody, you know, do you drink coffee? Yeah. What do you want? Espresso, no sugar.
Oh, you want.
We're cool. That's all I need to know. We're friends.
Well, that must mean that when you toured in Italy, you probably that was probably the best thing ever.
One of the fondest memories of Italy that I had is that all I had to do was go anywhere and ask un caffè per favore.
Yes.
A coffee. That's all I had to ask, and I didn't have to say anything else.
Yeah.
And the coffee was perfect.
Yes.
That's and there was no question that what I was asking, or they put milk, water.
Right.
I'd like a coffee, thank you.
Yeah, awesome. What, all right, what is the either the most bizarre, the funniest, or the strangest moment on stage that involves you?
Well, one would be falling off stage because, you know, the stage collapsed.
Wait, both of those things happened?
Well, the same thing. The stage collapsed and I ended up falling.
I need some more information.
I was sitting down playing and all of a sudden, we're grooving and we move our bodies, and I'm a big guy too, so you know the whole thing is moving, and all of a sudden there was the whole stage, and bass player with a huge Ampeg right next to me, you know, the whole stage starts going like this, going in, and we sort of start going sliding like that, and we both with the Ampeg, the drum set, and the whole thing, we all ended up crashing.
Oh my gosh, did you get hurt?
Not majorly, you know, the bruises and, you know, because it all happened sort of like in slow motion. So I was at least able to just hold the amp. It didn't follow me or anything like that.
Uh-huh.
We called the refrigerator.
Okay.
You know, but I held the cymbals and stuff like that. So they would cut me, you know, but I followed that and bruises and stuff like that.
Yeah.
That and the time that I went to do a gig with a couple of rappers that invited me last minute. I was like, sure. And they said, oh, there's a live band. I was like, oh, fantastic. There's a live band. That would be fun. Playing congas and stuff like that. And I show up and the musicians, they couldn't play a note to save their lives. And the rappers were furious. These two African Fulani rappers, they were furious because they had sent the tapes and they said, oh, we got it. We're fine. And, you know, and eventually the musicians started feeling so embarrassed that they actually started leaving the stage while the gig was happening.
Oh my God.
And one of the rappers was just so furious eventually, you know, kicked everybody off stage and went and got their CD with their backing tracks and put on the CD. And I'm like, I'm not getting down. You called me yesterday to do this gig and I learned all the tunes. Put the CD, I'll play.
Yeah.
So I was the only one left on a stage with a CD and the two rappers.
Oh, my God. So maybe you didn't do any more gigs with them after that, is what you're saying? No. Gotcha. All right, and lastly, what one piece of art, whether it's music, movies, podcasts, YouTube clips, visual art, theater, whatever, has impacted you the most recently?
Anything by John Cage.
Okay.
Recently I'm saying recently in the larger span, not recently in the last couple of months, but okay. Recently in the, you know, in the last few years, the more I read about John Cage, the more interesting it becomes, and the more interesting his way of thinking of music it is, because to me John Cage's basic question is that's what he does. He makes us question. So the most interesting question that he's asking is, what is music? Mm-hmm. You know, which as musicians, we should be able to define it.
Right.
But then I ask every single musician that I meet, what is music? And everybody is like, I don't know. But you do this for a living. You do this every day. You love it. And you have no idea what it is.
Right.
You know, and, you know, it's like, oh, it's just notes. Is it just notes? Is it that? You know, so... So John Cage makes us question that very profoundly, you know. Of course, his most famous piece being 433, of a piece of not playing music.
Right.
So go, is this music? You know, what is this? Is it music? Well, music is made out of silence and sound. So the fact that it's silence, or quote-unquote silence, so silence is not really attainable,
mm-hmm.
also Cage thought, it is something that it really makes us question how we music and how we understand music and how we interact with music and why is it important and, you know, at what point do we draw the line? And, you know, so it has made me come up with my own definitions of music, etc. So it's gotten me thinking. John Cage's music and writings have gotten me thinking a lot for the last few years. My definition of music, the definition that I've come up with, is consciously organized sound and time. Not, you know, there has to be a consciousness, there has to be an organization, there has to be sound, however you want to define sound, and it's happening over time. And that allows for an enormous amount of elements to be part of music.
Right.
You know, I am a strong believer on the expansion of our musical systems. You know, staying within, this goes back to my teacher telling me that music died after Bach.
Right, of course.
You know, and I'm a strong believer on 21st century music. You know, we can expand all of this to an incredible amount, and still it's music. Mm-hmm. So with that expansion in mind, what is music? How far can we take it? When does it stop being music? There you go.
Great.
An enormous amount of thanks to Andres for his time and expertise. I can't wait to hear more from him in the coming years, and I hope that he makes another appearance at PASIC soon. This week's rave is the Mark Maron book, Attempting Normal, published in 2013. I've mentioned Mark Maron a number of times in the past because he's a pretty big influence on me and this show. He's been doing his WTF podcast for nearly 10 years and has developed a style and a way with his guests that's always intriguing and entertaining to listen to. Recently, he's been one of the stars on the Netflix series Glow, which posted its second season a couple of months ago. If you have Netflix, I highly recommend it. He's turning into a really good actor, which, if you listen to his show, you'd know how surprised even he is about that. The book, Attempting Normal, chronicles a number of episodes in his life, including parts of his upbringing, how he got into comedy, the accounts of his two failed marriages, his life with cats, and many other events. It's also loaded with great bits and takes. Here's one of my favorites, from a chapter entitled Dunk the Clown, on page 143, where he's encountering a clerk in a jean shop. Again, this is Mark Maron's take. Quote, "The clerk helping me was a chubby fellow with a handlebar mustache. I have no patience for contemporary handlebar mustaches. They anger me. They look indulgent and ridiculous. Anytime I see one, all I can imagine is the guy twisting away at the waxed curls in his mirror like a villain of self-avoidance. If you have a handlebar mustache, that is pretty much all you are. You are a delivery system for a handlebar mustache." Unquote. If you enjoyed that, and I know I did, check out Attempting Normal and check out his podcast, WTF. And that's our show. Listen and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts and leave a comment and a rating. Listen to the show on SoundCloud, Stitcher, and wherever else you get your podcasts. For all previous episodes and show notes, check out the homepage at petezambito.com/Pete's Percussion Podcast, the episodes. If you're on Facebook, like the page Pete's Percussion Podcast. You can contact me there, on Instagram and Twitter at Pete Zambito, or by email at petesperkpod@gmail.com, and I'll catch you next time. Until then.